Here tonight, and this service is important to you. I ought to maybe share something because we hadn't shared about it because it might lead to more questions that would be unproductive. For the last few weeks, we've been doing small groups that many of you may have heard tell of, or we've tried to stay under the radar, though. And the reason we stayed under the radar was because we're doing a trial basis for 8 weeks, and it started 5 weeks ago. And we wanted to see if small home groups is something that would work for us. And so some of the leaders are normally attenders on Sunday night, and they just haven't quit, but they're out leading those groups. And we're essentially targeting people who would come on Sunday morning, probably mainly between the ages of 20 and 40, that really have not, for whatever reason, bought into the traditional Sunday school model. And so that's going to go on probably for another 3 weeks, and then we're going to take the summer off, and we're going to sit around and think about what we're going to do and come up with another plan in August. But we are working very hard to try to build the Sunday school back to previous numbers, and I'm excited about that. We've got some 12-step programs started, and really, when you hear 12-step, you think psychology. It's really a Bible study group, but it's better to call it 12-step. And then very excited. We're planning, and this is more of a brainchild of Rachel and Sarah, but we're going to begin to do some parenting classes starting in August that will be during the Sunday school hour, led by Rachel and Sarah, and then Todd Aiken will be involved in that as well. But if anybody should know anything about parenting, it's two gals with 9 kids between them, right? And so we're very excited about that. So we're not going to touch Sunday school, but we are going to bring in, and Ralph has brought in the 12 steps. We're going to begin to build some parenting classes, and we are experimenting with the possibility, and I feel pretty excited. We've had pretty strong numbers. We've probably 30 to 40 people weekly meeting in these home groups. It's sort of a different kind of thing. They are actually longer than Sunday school. They've been lasting for about an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes, where essentially I type up a study guide based on the Sunday morning sermon, and they sit around, and that is the lesson that they cover on Sunday night. So I say all that because we didn't bring that up because we didn't want 100 people being involved, because we only had space for about 50 at max, and we didn't want to get into a situation where we had to say no. And so we flew it under the radar. But give those people that you look around, don't be praying that they'll get saved and return from their backsliding. They're not backsliding. They'll be back. And we'll hopefully have a broader plan. And if that's something that appeals to you, hopefully we'll have something to offer you in August. Also, I want to say this, and Trey, you have to forgive me. I just want to share some good news tonight because they look like they need some good news. Through Trey's leadership and his committee, and mainly 99.9% of it is through your giving. Financially, we're in a very good place. Trey would say we're in the best place we've been in maybe 10 years or so. I don't know, but that's Trey. And you know, accountants, it all depends on how you add the numbers, you know. But we are planning to spend. Trey, can I say it, or are you going to shoot me? You got a bow and arrow up there? Okay. Probably in the next few weeks we'll announce this. So we are planning to spend upwards to $100,000 in the coming months to begin the remodel of the Family Life Center. And your giving has made that possible. Your giving has also made it possible. Last fiscal year, we retired. We're not talking about interest, but we were able to retire nearly $220,000 in debt in a 12-month period due to your giving. And we've been able to save again to begin the remodel of the Family Life Center. Thank you for your giving. Thank you for your giving. We don't trumpet that so much because anytime you say what we've done with the money, you've got 10 people say, well, you shouldn't have done that. You should have done something else with the money. You think you're doing something good, and it ends up being a conflicting kind of thing. But it is our goal in the last probably year and a half, we have reduced our loan balance by about $300,000. Be nice to go another 12 months, and if we could knock out another $200,000, then if we want to back up on that and start putting it in other places, we hope the giving sort of catches up and we can continue to reduce it at that rate. But it is nice to take about 2.5-3 years and slug about $500,000 off of that deficit, and it sort of frees us up, I think, at least mentally, to go off and do other things. So there are good things happening. I hope you see that as good things, and I hope you don't argue with me at the back door and say, are you doing it all wrong? I understand that, but you may be right. But Matthew chapter 5, verse 21-27, and let me get on the ball here. We got a bowl, right? Get going, huh? Okay. Jesus has been preaching here, and Sermon on the Mount, and he has said something in verse 20 that, as Desi Arnaz would say, takes some splaining. He's got to splain himself. And what he said in verse 20 is, for I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So he's saying, what you do has to exceed what the Pharisees are doing or are striving to be. You need to exceed that. And so then he gives six ways in which you need to exceed that. And I'd like to talk to the first point tonight. Verse 21, he says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. For whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you that you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. Jesus is saying your righteousness has to exceed that of the Pharisees. And so the first illustration that he gives is in verse 21. And he simply says this. He says, the Pharisaic teachers said that murder is about the heart, but I say to you that murder, is about the hand, but I say to you that murder is about the heart. Notice that's the first area that you and I are called to go beyond what the Pharisees taught. You have heard it said of old, you shall not murder. Now, I think that was an easy one for the Pharisees, and that was an easy one for them. I mean, how many people have actually ever killed somebody in their life? And so I think the bar is at least starting a little low. He said, everybody knows, the Pharisees know that the Bible says, you shall not murder. It's in the Ten Commandments. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't ever kill a person. Murder and killing aren't the same thing in the Old Testament. There were reasons to kill. One of them was in self-defense. In fact, in Exodus chapter 22, verse 2, it says that if a person breaks into your house at night to rob you, and you kill them, there's no penalty for that. It's self-defense. Now, verse 3 of that chapter is interesting. It says, now in daytime, if they break in the still and you kill them, there's a problem with that because, and I think the issue there is that if they break in and you see that they're trying to steal something, you can't kill them. But at night, you don't know if they're stealing or if they're trying to kill you. So if you kill them, there's no penalty there. But again, self-defense was a valid reason to take a life in the Old Testament, and it was not held against the person who did it. Capital punishment was not considered murder in the Old Testament. In fact, there were 16 to 19 capital offenses in the Old Testament. There were at least 16 reasons to receive the death penalty in the Old Testament. Again, it was hardly a time when the death penalty was considered taboo. Also, killing in times of war. again, not considered to be murder. If that was the case, then David, for instance, would have been a serial killer because he was a man of war. So, again, killing and murder weren't the same thing, obviously, in the Old Testament. But if you killed somebody and it wasn't in self-defense, if it wasn't in the context of I want to say war, but even in along the proper, I mean, there's still morality in war, but in the context of a battle, and again, even war is considered self-defense. If it wasn't in the context of punishing an evildoer, then it was considered murder. Pharisees say, we understand that, and we don't murder. Murder's about what you do with your hands. But notice what Jesus said. He said, it's just not what you do with your hands, it's what you also do in your heart. He says, you've heard it said to the of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Now, it's well known that in the Greek language, the Greeks were far more specific than we are in their wording. And so it's well known, for instance, there were multiple words that all get translated love, and there are different kinds of love, but in our translations it's all comes in as love, and you got to go back to the original Greek to get the more specific meaning. That's also true of anger. One of the words that is often used of anger in the Bible is the Greek word thumos. And thumos, William Barclay put it this way. He said thumos is anger. The picture of thumos is straw catching on fire. It catches on fire, it quickly burns up the straw, and then it's over. He said, that's a picture of thumos. Thumos is the kind of anger that you get when you're watching your favorite team play in the tournament, and it's a tie game, and the ref makes a horrible call that cost your team the game. It's fast. It usually goes away, and it doesn't tend to hang on too long. It's a passionate anger. It's what you feel sometimes in traffic, isn't it? It's what you feel if you got a hot cup of coffee and you walk into your table and somebody bumps your elbow. It's thumos. It's fast. It's quick, but it oftentimes goes away quickly as well. There's another word called ortho, and that's the word that's used here, because ortho meant simmering. And when I think of ortho, if you're using a fire analogy, I remember that many of the homes that I lived in growing up, Dad would start a fire in winter, and that fire, and many of you have done this, that fire would last for weeks. It's in the fireplace, and that thing got fed, and one of his goals during those winter months is not to let the fire go out, because that's a problem. Keep making sure the logs, but I want to see embers in there at all times, and he would try to control it, but he would feed that fire for weeks, and that's the anger that Jesus is talking about. I don't think he's saying it's okay to get thumos, to get angry and to hit the ceiling. I think that probably that there's probably some leniency on that, because I think it's a lot of human nature there. But what he's talking about is that slow simmering anger that gets fed week in, month in, year in. That slow churning anger that you have to feed. Now, what does he say that if you do that, you're guilty of the judgment? And you got to understand it, and I know this is very simple, but God judges you on your motive. Understand that it's not the act, it's the motive. It's the motive that counts, and to some degree, morality is based on what you would do if you were absolutely certain you could get away with it. And I think when God looks at the heart of somebody who fuels that, it's hatred, and often comes in when it's translated in the Bible, it's often translated as wrath. That wrath, that slow burning anger. I think God looks at that, and he looks at our intent, and he says, because of what you're feeding in your life, if you were absolutely certain you could get away with it and you would never be punished, what you have inside of you is a motive for murder. You would probably murder if you were absolutely sure you'd get away with it, because you're feeding that. You're not letting it go. It won't die, and you don't want it to die. You keep feeding that thing in your life. So he says to these Pharisees, he said, murder isn't just about the hand, but it's also about the heart. Your hands need to be clean, but your heart needs to be clean too. Then he goes on and he says, and I want to talk to you about your language. He said, because language is just not about vulgarity. Language is not just about vulgarity, but it's also about slander. Notice what he says in verse 22, halfway down. And he says, and whoever says in it, to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hellfire. Now what does he mean by Raca? He said, if you say Raca, you could get hauled up before the council. And I don't know that anybody has a good read on what Raca meant, but what it seems to be, and I think we can agree on, or I think the scholars agree, pardon me on that, is that Raca was the equivalent of a swear word, and probably a pretty vile word. And so what he's saying is, if you're heard in public saying Raca, that would be a really bad swear word, and you could get hauled up before the judge for saying that because it's public vulgarity. He said, but I'm telling you that language just isn't about not saying swear words, but it's also what you say about other people that I'm looking at. And he says, saying Raca can get you in trouble with the council, but saying you fool can get you in trouble with the ultimate judge, which is God, and that can get you sent to hell. Now, what does he mean by you fool? And I think I've touched on this maybe a couple times in the last few months, but let me just touch on it very briefly. When he says you fool, he isn't talking about calling somebody ignorant per se. In the Old Testament, and that's the context here, fool always meant a vile or evil person. And let me just show you those texts again that I've showed you previously. Psalm 14:1. Notice the equivalency. To the chief musician, a psalm of David, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now it doesn't say they're ignorant and stupid. It says they are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. So notice the fool doubts God. They're corrupt. They do terrible things, abominable things. They do awful, bad things. Now the next passage, if you will. Isaiah 32:6. For the foolish person will speak foolishness, and his heart will work iniquity to practice ungodliness, yada, 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 yada. But I think you see that. The foolish person is a person who works iniquity, they practice ungodliness. And then 2 Samuel, if you will. Remember Nabal? Guy who wouldn't give David and his men any food. And so this is Abigail, his wife, speaking to David. She says, please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, and his name was actually Fool, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly, you want to say, is his game, right? But it doesn't say. Nabal is his name, and folly is in him. It's not the poetry you're looking for right there. But in any case, And folly, sometimes we think of folly as foolishness, but if you look that up in the Hebrew, the word for folly is villainry. Villainry is his game. He's a villain. He's an awful person. And so that was the context of fool. So what Jesus is saying is that if you look at a person and you call them evil, you question their character, you question their motives, that can get you into deep trouble with God. And actually, there's a sense in which he's saying the four-letter word is bad, but the assault of a person's character is worse. Now, you say, well, that means you ought not lie against a person. And that's true, but understand the Pharisees knew their Ten Commandments, and one of the Ten Commandments was lying. So when he says assaulting somebody's character, he's not necessarily saying, and don't tell lies about a person's character. I think what he's doing is he's attacking what can often happen among nice people. And I think he's talking more about questioning or blacking another person's motives, which doesn't tend to get classified as lying. I mean, at least, you know, I grew up in the church. It tends not to be considered lying to question a person's motives. Although, it's pretty effective in making a person look bad. For instance, and I don't have a dog in this fight, but for 5 hours on the news on Friday, the commentators, because there's a lot of bad stuff going on in the world, right? There's a lot of newsworthy stuff. But for 5 hours, the news was, did the president intentionally not shake Angela Merkel's hand? Was that intentional? Because usually when they do the press conference and Angela Merkel's the prime minister of Germany, she's there and he was there. But they usually shake a hand and smile, but they just smiled this time. Now, I don't know what happened there, but there were those who would say, well, that he didn't mean to do that. He's forgetful. He's 70 years old, for crying out loud. He might have forgot to shake the hand. I mean, you don't always shake the hand that you should shake. But there were others who, I mean, they went to town on his motives. And maybe he did have a bad motive, but the only person who knows whether he forgot or whether he was intentional is him. They don't really know his motive, but they really went to town on the motive. Now, that happens to President Trump, happened to President Obama. That tends to be how we treat our politicians. We tend to make it as hard on them as possible to do their job for us. And so it's part of it. But there is a way that is acceptable, even among religious people, of questioning a person's motive and blacking their character. You know, a person will do something, and maybe it's a nice thing, but people will say, well, you know why they did that. You know why they did that. They're just trying to get ahead, or they're trying to fool somebody. Or they, I know it looks like they did right, but their motives weren't very good. Well, how do you know what their motives are? How would you know what their motives are? Well, I know that's what they said, but I'll tell you why they said it, because I can read minds. That I know they said it, but they didn't have a good, their heart wasn't in the right place when they said it. They just said it because they have to. They really didn't mean it. Well, how do you know they really didn't mean it? You know they really didn't mean it. Maybe they were being nice and they meant to be nice and they weren't out to do anything other than to be nice. See, it's perfectly acceptable to call people, quote, unquote, you fool. Now, we're not lying. What we're doing is we're having a conversation where we're examining, and I don't even know what we call it, but we don't call it sin. I remember talking to a guy once, and you have to forgive me on this. I hope I don't offend you here. He had a lot of issues with his pastor, and so he was dumping on me, another pastor. I pastored a church, and he had pastored down the he attended a church down the road, and we ended up in this conversation. So he's really doing the laundry list on this guy, and this guy was a horrible pastor. He like used notes when he preached, which was terrible. It meant that the Holy Spirit wasn't talking to him, and according to this guy, you know, he didn't quite visit like he should. And so he does this laundry list of everything terrible about this pastor, none of which could technically be called a sin. And then he said, and I'll tell you what's worse. Do you know what he's got on in the back of his car? He's got a bumper sticker that says, "Drive faster, I've got to pee." Now, what kind of preacher would have a bumper sticker like that on his car? And I wouldn't have that bumper sticker on my car. But it's just interesting that here's a guy who takes exception at the word P-E-E. That's vulgar to him. That's raca. But it's not a problem for him to spend 10 minutes running down a man and questioning his motives. He doesn't have a problem. He's got a problem with the word P-E-E. He doesn't have a problem with standing around for 10 minutes tearing the man up. And that is a problem oftentimes in Christianity. And you go out to the restaurant and you hear Christians talk, they're very offended by four-letter words. They're not so offended sitting around impugning other people's motives like they can read their minds. But I think Jesus is saying, but it's important to me. It's important to me. Vulgarity is one thing, but attacking a person's character unjustly, and again, we don't call that lying. I don't know why we don't call that lying, because it's like guessing. You don't know their motives, but I'm taking a good guess at maybe what their motives is, and I may not be right, but if I'm not right, it's still not lying. I wasn't right, but I didn't lie. See, he's saying that counts too. Now, thirdly, he says, murder is just not about the hand, it's also about the heart. He says vulgarity isn't just about four-letter words, but it's also what you say about other people and their motives. But he also says, it's not enough to have a right relationship with God, you also have to have a right relationship with others. In other words, to be right with God, you got to be right with others too. And I think the Pharisees, from what I can gather, would say, hey, I'm right with God. It doesn't matter if I'm right with other people. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if I'm in proper relationships with other people. That doesn't matter. I've got a lot of conflict, but you know what? I go to church. I worship God. I'm right with God. And, you know, I don't have a great relationship with the other Christians in the church. I don't have a great relationship with my family. I'm not very good with relationships, but I got a great relationship with God. And Jesus saying, no, see, that won't work. You got to have a relationship with God, but you also have to have a good relationship with other people. Notice he says, verse 23, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave the gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. And when he says, if you remember your brother having aught, we've talked about this in previous times, but I don't take it brother being an ought as somebody not liking something about you or somebody mad about something you did. To me, ought is a genuine offense because, again, it'd be hard for a preacher to preach on Sunday if he had to be right with everybody who didn't like anything about him. I mean, it would be hard. I mean, we all live lives and there are people that don't like things that we've done and there are people that think we ought to maybe have done things different. And you have that and I have that. But ought is a genuine wrong that you've committed that you have not resolved with somebody else. They've got reason against you. They've got ought against you. He says, you need to go, you need to be reconciled with them because it's not enough to be right with me. I know you're bringing your offering to me. I know you're worshiping me, but that's not enough. You need to go and you need to be right with everybody else too. Then in verse 25, he drives home the seriousness of this and he makes it brutally serious by giving an illustration. Verse 25, agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out until you have paid the last penny. Again, the imagery there is a cultural one, and he says, if you owe somebody any amount of money, and they come to you, and this is a cultural thing, if somebody had wronged you, you could go, you didn't call the policeman, they didn't really have a police force, you'd go, you'd get them, you'd drag them to the judge. It's like, come here, you owe me money, you could get them, drag him to the judge. That's what I think, by the way, is going on in John chapter 8, where the woman's caught in the act of adultery. They didn't call police. They didn't go. They just got her. They drug her to the judge, in that case, which was Jesus. And so if you owe somebody a little money, they come, they get you, they're going to take you to the judge. Jesus says, if you're smart, you fix it on the road and do whatever it takes to get it fixed between your house and the judge's house. So if you have to, you know, say, hey, I'll pay you and I'll pay you interest. I'll do whatever you want. I'll pay you twice what I owe you. However you need to do that, fix it on the road. Because if it gets to the judge, judges in that day were apparently not like judges in our day. If it gets to the judge, he's going to ask, do you owe him any money? And if you say yes, that's it. You're going to jail. So fix it on the road, because if it gets to the judge, you're going to jail. Pay what you have to pay here, because you don't want to end up in jail. And of course, he's not talking about really debt, but he's talking about us. The road is life. And he's saying to us, if you got a problem with a brother or a sister, do whatever it takes to fix it in life, because I assure you, it's going to go worse if it makes it to the final judgment. You don't want this thing going to the final judgment. Fix it during this life. Fix it on the road. I watched a documentary over the weekend on a guy named H.R. Haldeman. And some of you are old enough to remember H.R. Haldeman. He was the chief assistant to Richard Nixon. And he ended up serving some time in jail because of Watergate. But when Watergate was really in its full flower, there were leaks all over the place. And Richard Nixon finally had enough of all the people in the White House talking, sneaking and talking to the press. So he had all the people in the White House in one room, and he came in and he said, Haldeman has all my authority. He's going to pursue every leak. And if you are accused of a leak, I'm giving him authority to destroy you. And if you're accused of a leak, I don't want to hear from you, because mark it down, I will be far worse on you than Haldeman is going to be. There's a sense in which I hate to equate Jesus with Richard Nixon. That's not the intent of the illustration. But there's a sense in which that's what Jesus is saying. Fix it on the road. If it costs you a little more to get the conflict fixed, pay what it costs. If you got to go in debt, go in debt. Do whatever it takes to fix the conflicts you have with others in this life, because if it makes it to the judgment, don't think for a second that you're going to receive mercy from God. Don't think that you're going to do that. I think I've shared this before, but I was talking to a guy, and he had a conflict with another guy in the church that he had gone to. He wasn't a pastor, but it was a conflict over something pretty silly. If I told you, it would just sound so silly that it destroyed the illustration. But it was stupid. It was stupid. But one guy ended up leaving the church over this really silly conflict. And I think about 20 years passed. They had this conflict. They didn't really talk over this silly thing. And finally, the guy who stayed went to the guy who had left, and he essentially said, you know, I really want to get this fixed between us. It's been in the way of my prayer life, and the Lord keeps bringing it up. And I just think that whatever happened back then, we need to put behind us, and we need to get settled. And the guy looked at him and said, oh, no, it's bigger than that. I can't reconcile with you here. We're going to have to take this to the judgment. That's what Jesus is saying. Don't you do that. Because see, Jesus is going to be there, and he's the one who on the cross looked at all those people who had crucified him and said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's the judge that he's going to be there. He's going to be there. And so anything that you've got is probably lesser than that. You're not going to get understanding at the judgment. You're not. So Jesus said, whatever you do, fix it on the road. Again, he looks at the Pharisees and he said, listen, or he looks at his disciples and said, your righteousness has to exceed that of the Pharisees. For them, murder's in the hand. For you, it's in the heart. For them, vulgarity is just about four-letter words. For me, vulgarity is really about the four-letter words, but it's also what you say and what you imply about other people. For them, they can have a relationship with God, but be at conflict with other people. But for my people, that can't be so. If you want to be right with me, you also have to be right with other people. Lest your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees, Jesus said, you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Maybe there's a person here, and I'm going to close. We're not going to do an altar call, but you're thinking about your life right now. Maybe there's a person that you know in your life that you're at odds with. You're just at odds with. Why don't you do something about it? You're still on the road. Make a phone call. The Lord is putting somebody on your heart right now that you're at odds with, and it's there, and maybe for whatever reason you've neglected it, but the Holy Spirit is speaking to you right now about that person, and the Holy Spirit is great about bringing somebody to your mind. It's just great about that. Write the letter. Make the call. Make the visit. Get that thing settled while you're on the road. When you do that, you're going to feel better. God's going to be glorified. And your life is going to come in line with the teaching of Jesus Christ. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. When you became a Christian, you became a disciple of Jesus. You became a person who was committed to following his teaching. The Holy Spirit is speaking to you about a person. Follow his teaching. Do what he's calling you to do. Make the call. Send the Facebook request. Do whatever you have to do. But make that right while you're still on the road. Will you stand with me?